Hi, dear people, and welcome to For Real. I'm your host, Kim Stewart, and today I am joined by a remarkable woman. Andy Kolber is an author, speaker, and therapist, and her books, Try Softer and Strong Like Water, are insightful, kind, compassionate, and so wise. Andy is a trauma expert and a trauma survivor, and I trust her so profoundly to give sound counsel on a really difficult subject. This conversation is for you if you have been through or are going through trauma, or you know someone who has survived or is currently walking through something traumatic. Pretty sure that covers all of us. Let's get right to it. A hope-filled and resource-rich conversation with Andy Kolber. Andy Kolber, thank you so much for joining me today on For Real. It is a pleasure to have you.
Oh, it's great to be with you.
I know you're talking to us from Michigan, where it just snows all the time. I was just in that neck of the woods, and I just want to say you are an intrepid person. I like snow, but I measure inches. You guys measure feet.
Well, I am learning a new level of winter.
Wow.
This is my second Michigan winter. And lots of respect. Lots of respect for Michiganders. And, you know, Colorado sort of prepared me, but the lake effect snow is next level for sure.
Yeah. I thought you guys were whining. And now I know after this weekend on the road, you aren't whining. You're actually total realists. Andy, I have so many questions for you. I'm so excited to dive in. Before we get to the heart of what you have so much to teach us about so many things, I would love a kind of a 30,000 foot view. You are an author and a speaker and a therapist and a mom and a wife and a Michigander. I'm sure there are roles in there that I missed, but how do you like the mix? Just human to human. Is this the life you expected? Do you like it?
Mm-hmm. What, that's beautiful. That's actually a really beautiful question. I am honestly sometimes amazed that I have found a way, I think by the grace of God, to sort of, you know, cobble together things that are both a combination of skill and then sort of passion. You know, I think to be a person in writing spaces, to speak to even just the creative aspect, some of those things, as much as they're informed by like my therapeutic work, it also is expression of other things, you know, just like the artistic elements of it. And the flexibility is helpful, you know, as a mom. And there's certainly some really challenging parts of this work too. I kind of feel like I don't exactly have a roadmap. I think that when you have a career that's a little bit more standard and someone can kind of say, here's what you do. And so to be in a space where I wear so many different hats, and not just career-wise, but just generally to be a person, I think of, because so much of my values, my ethos is to really honor my capacity, to honor my joy, to honor my own work of being human. Sometimes that pushes up against cultural norms. And I feel that sometimes. So I really love the work I'm doing, and it's really hard. I love being a mom, and that can be really hard. But I am grateful for the life that I get to live. And certainly there's always things I'm always looking to figure out, how can I live more into who I'm created to be? And I'm coming to the end of my 40th year. And it's been a transformative year for me, not just because of turning 40, but I think of my own continued deepening into like who God made me to be and how that reverberates, I think, out through all of those different identities.
I love the work you do. I don't see you mother, and I don't see you in your snow plowing moment, but I know you only through your books and from hearing you speak. And you work in particular with this wisdom that I think it belies your age. I almost fell off my chair just now that you said that you were 40. I mean, you look like you're 10, but also you have wisdom that is not for a 40-year-old. You work to help people heal from trauma. trauma is a word that I feel has been battered about and bandied about in a way that maybe doesn't, to use your language, honor it. So it's overused. I think a lot of times people say it was a traumatic event not to get their coffee in the timely manner. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? And so I'm wondering if before we move into the space where you have really helped so many people and continue to help people, will you give us a definition of what you mean when you say trauma, when you say you are a trauma therapist?
Yeah, I definitely will. And before I go there, I think, the thing I would just say, because I think this is something people are discussing, which I think is valuable. You know, I think precision in language is helpful.
Right.
You know, and I think it helps people who identify with the language to feel honored. Mm-hmm. And so part of what I would just say is that I think that when we come from a place where we're using it as a joke and it's not in alignment with the reality of what you actually think even about the experience, like this example you gave about like not getting your coffee on time, right? I think if we're being authentic, we realize that actually that's kind of being dismissive.
Right.
Who is that dismissing?
Totally.
Well, people who've experienced something that's really harmful and oftentimes is so harmful that it then lives in their body.
Okay.
And I'll get into that definition a little bit more. But one thing I will say is that I am sort of an advocate for the expansion of the definition of trauma. We are just beginning to have the language to name the level at which there has been harm that's happened or pain or experiences that are so disturbing. And decades upon decades upon, you know, centuries, maybe has never been validated as being potentially traumatic. So I think there's like the both and. And that's why I think having, you know, the definition is helpful. But I think the sort of the give and take here is to recognize that, generally speaking, our definition of trauma has been too narrow.
Okay.
And in doing that, I think some of the repercussion of that is that many people who have really significant pain and wounding and disturbances that live in their body have felt that they don't have any ground to stand on.
Okay.
To say that they're not okay.
Okay. Yeah. So this is great. This is really helping us figure things out. So I am also a Midwesterner, and we're going to talk about your definition of strength in a minute, which I think is super powerful. But I'd love you to keep pushing there. Mm-hmm. So help us know what trauma might look like. I think the spaces where I'm older than you are, but growing up, if I would have heard that, I would have assumed it was at the ER. So something fairly traumatic, violent to the body, or abuse. And the more I read about this, the more I realize that definition, you're right, is a little narrow. Those are important spaces, but also I'm thinking about, you know, my friend, both of her parents died on the same day. Mm. And, you know, another friend who has gone through just a gutting experience through the pandemic, things that maybe we didn't even, I'm reaching with my hands right now because we didn't even have the boxes for that or open boxes for that. So tell me what it might look like for the listener who's asking, what does that mean? What does trauma look like? It's a big question, but if you can help me put some scaffolding on that, that would be great.
Yeah. Well, so what I would say is, and this is for me, this definition is definitely building on the work of some really sort of trailblazers in the field, people like Peter Levine and Dr. Dan Siegel and, you know, like Pat Ogden. There's been some really important sort of work done in the area of understanding and expanding our definition of trauma. But how I look at it is really any experience, moment, sensation, even memory that is so overwhelming to our nervous system that it exceeds our capacity to cope and the nervous system's capacity to cope. And what happens is that because it's exceeding that capacity, and I'll talk about that a little bit more even, what's happening is that we're not able to essentially metabolize what's happened to us, which is part of what's essential to happen for anything that we go through. We essentially, we process it. And in processing it, we're essentially filing it away in our body correctly. It's like our body is able to say, oh, okay, that's over now. It's in the past. Here's like what I learned. Here's like, I'm going to store this in long-term memory. Here's things that I don't really need. And it's sort of like, I mean, this is doesn't really do justice to how complicated our body is, but essentially it's like a really good filing system. And those that system is able to really shrink those files. And when we think about the memory of whatever we experienced, we think about it like it's in the past. And typically there's not disturbance connected to it. Now, that doesn't mean that when we think about it, it was the perfect experience.
Right.
It means that our body is not re-experiencing it.
Okay.
So when we're talking about trauma, the difference is that because the event, and again, and I'm going to unpack it even more after I say this, but something that we go through that, let's say you're a child, okay, and you have a really terrible day at school, and you come home to where is hopefully, ideally, a place that feels safe, you know, like a place where you can sort of exhale and feel like you're seen. But you come home and you kind of, you know, you're trying to communicate to a caregiver like, oh gosh, it was a really hard day. And let's say the response to that is that you are shamed or you're yelled at or that you're told like what a disappointment you are or any number of things that in that moment, particularly developmentally, a kiddo's brain is really not fully processed. I mean, the prefrontal cortex, which is a really essential part of our brain, is far from being formed. And in order to process a difficult and metabolize an experience like I named, you actually need that prefrontal cortex. So when the person or a caregiver that you needed becomes almost like the source of also the threat, that would be an example of a situation that has the potential. And I want to say that very clearly. It's because not every experience that's potentially traumatic will become trauma. Part of it is about how, like, do you have the support? Do you have the care you need as you go through it? Because that will give anyone, whether that's a kiddo or an adult or a teenager, it will give us a better chance of our body being able to process the experience completely and well. So it doesn't get stored in our body in a fragmented way. And therefore, when something reminds us of the experience, we begin to re-experience it. And that's what we would consider a trigger. Is when something is sort of cueing that same sort of event and our body perceives that they're similar and therefore we re-experience the event.
So is the nervous system the ninja move, which is a very cumbersome way of saying really important. Is that really our best signpost of when something needs to be unpacked a little bit, healed, processed? I mean, I have a very dear friend who I think represents more than just himself. He has said to me several times, he questions even the value of visiting the past. So he has said to me, why I hated that. Why would I look at that again? Whatever happened when I was younger or things that were hurtful to me. Why would I take that out of the closet, take another look when I really don't want to think about that again? So how do you coach that person? Are there times when you just say, yep, we're not going to go there again? Is the nervous system the signpost for him that if he is his physical body reacts to that memory? Is that a hint that maybe he has some things to heal from or process?
Yeah. Well, the first thing I want to say, you know, to someone who's listening and maybe who hasn't done sort of trauma work and really maybe doesn't want to, you know, even, I think it's really important for anyone, whether they identify themselves as a survivor of trauma or not, to just know how important it is to like honor sort of our choice. So like, if like, let's say someone came to me and like, let's say they were even a client and they were like, I want to meet with you, but like, I don't want to work on the past. Certainly that would make things a little bit tricky, right? But what I would want to help them understand is that like, I will never, and this is what I think a good honoring sort of dignifying posture is that that person gets to honor the pace of their own body. So like I think it's important to understand, like, yes, I do believe that there's like connections to the past that live in our body, and that there's lots of evidence and neurobiology that teaches us that when something hasn't fully processed, it's actually not really over because it's actually still alive in your body. And it hasn't, because it hasn't fully processed, our body actually doesn't know the difference between past or present when we are re-experiencing it.
Whoa.
So I could point to lots of evidence, but like, I would never want to push someone or shame them into feeling like, hey, you have to, like, you don't have a choice. Because what I would say is that for lots of trauma survivors, and again, I want to use that term kind of widely, because a lot of people would not ever identify themselves that way. But for people who have parts of their story that continue to be painful in the present and are showing up in the present, I think it's really important to understand that our that internal resistance to go to the past is likely a part of something they've developed to help them survive and to continue functioning. Because our bodies are deeply wise. I mean, you know, often I do a lot of faith integration. And one thing for me is to say, you know, I really believe it's the grace of God, the way our bodies are designed, even our ability to go into like a fight or flight response, like even the ways that we adapt, because sometimes we really don't have a better choice. Like really, that is the way that we continue to function. So when I hear this story of your friend, like what it makes me mostly curious about is like, oh, that's, I wonder how that has been helpful for him. And I wonder why he has needed to feel like he could not ever revisit the past. And what I would say is that often for a person like that, what's needed is actually building up more resources. And what I mean by that is more experiences, moments, relationships that allow us to feel like essentially it enlarges our capacity. The more supported we feel, the more that we feel known and that like the present really is safe, for example, the easier it is to sort of, I think of it like maybe you just dip your tiny little toe in the past and that's all you do, right? Like you're not doing a deep dive off the end of the pool into the past. You're just like, yeah, I am aware of myself at 12 years old. I am aware that when I feel this anxiety in my chest, like there's something about that that feels really familiar to me. And maybe that's for like a person who's really just starting. Maybe that's it. That's it. Like that's just the beginning, is that there's just some kind of connection. Because what we're doing is we're trying to, and maybe a concept I might be able to unpack a little bit because it might be helpful for listeners, is the window of tolerance. To understand that there is a way for us to do this work that allows us to stay more present versus a way to do this work that it's more like a fire hose. And we think like, oh, if we're going to work on this thing, you're just going to take it. Like you're not, there's going to be no relief. It's going to be so painful. And so a lot of times what happens is that that's like the fear that people have.
For sure. I mean, this friend I'm talking about
there is definitely a reticence to even, that's where I think that's the root of that. What happens? I have neatly put this away, right? Like right. It's contained and I have a full and flourishing life that I don't want to disrupt. And why would the fire hose is a wonderful metaphor because I think that's the construct in this person's head that if I open that, there will be no relief and there will be no release. It will just be an intensive talk about jumping in the pool. Deep end, you are forced to swim. And you're saying the window of tolerance is something that you can cultivate where we live, where you can do this in a gentler, softer way. Is that a fair expose? And I'd love for you to talk about that and to talk about, we're going to go in just a second into how you have a total paradigm shift with strength, the way you write about this in your beautiful book, Strong Like Water. You reframe what it means to be strong. And I think these are connected. So you just go. I want to hear what you have to say.
I so appreciate that. I think how you summarize that is so valid. And I think so often people know, like they're like in their head, they're like, yeah, there is a lot that happened, but I don't dare open it up.
Right.
You know? And I think what I want to honor is like, I get that. I get, first of all, the fear of that. I get how scary that is, how chaotic. It sometimes can feel pointless or like, what is even the point? And so before I talk about the window of tolerance, what I want to name is that one of the things that's so paradoxical about this work is that, you know, there is a truth in which not every season is the time to dig into something. Like if you're facing something really hard in the present, it may not be the time to dig into the past. That's valid. I want people to hear that, you know? But what I find is that because of the way that our nervous system and our body works, there is a way in which we are designed. Like the Apostle Paul talks about, like we like groan, like all creation groans. Mm-hmm. I think there's a way in which we are designed to want healing. Mm. Like we are made for wholeness. Like there's a way in which it's not enough to settle just with being like half alive. And so when I think about folks like this, one of the things that sometimes happens, there's like often either something will happen in their life and it will bring something up for them and it will sort of split them open a little bit. And there will be an experience of like, whether I want to or not, this is here. The other thing that sometimes happens for folks is that they realize they don't have access to all their emotions. And they don't know why. They're like, I should be grateful. I want to be grateful. I want to feel joy. I want to connect with my kids. I want to connect with my friends. I want to connect with my spouse. I can't. I feel halfway here. So like those are two really common things that happen for people when they begin to say, wow, maybe the cost is higher than I realize of not dealing with these things. And what I would want to just say is that there really is many ways to begin to do this work gently. And I think that something like this concept of the window of tolerance, it was coined by Dr. Dan Siegel. And it's this concept of that we have this range of arousal in which we can feel our feelings or recall a memory or have a sensation or an experience. And we can essentially, like our brain and body, that prefrontal cortex that I named, it stays online. So really tangibly what that means is like, we're not going into a fight or flight or potentially a dissociative place. Like we are, when you think of how you feel when you sort of feel like yourself, this is typically like a little bit of like what it feels like when you're in your window of tolerance.
Okay.
It's not that you're perfect. It's not like things are not also still, like you're still a human, you know?
Right, sure.
But we have the best capacity to move through things, you know, and we-
In that window.
So yes. like we have the best capacity to also like have really complex thinking or like to think ahead or problem solve. We have the best capacity to be, you know, sort of more calm in the face of something difficult. So it's very much, I would think of as like sort of this resource place. But when our body perceives that there's a certain level of threat, we will begin to go into either our sympathetic nervous system, which is where like fight or flight, potentially fawn, which is essentially sort of a response where we learn to over accommodate to neutralize a threat. And then if those things don't work, if the sympathetic nervous system doesn't help us deal with the threat, we will drop down into what's known as like a dissociation. And that can go from all the way of being like a little numb or out of it to the point where if the threat is significant enough, we could even lose consciousness.
Wow.
And so it's important to understand this affects us. Like if someone's going through something traumatic, they almost certainly have left their window of tolerance. Mm-hmm. The difference is that they never return.
Okay.
So the event gets stuck in our body, the actual experience of being that far outside of mm-hmm. sort of ourselves is part of the thing that never got metabolized.
Okay.
And so the result of that is that that window, which every person, whether you've ever identified yourself as a trauma survivor, every person has a window. And when you have experienced something that has left a significant wounding or something in your body, that window shrinks a little bit. And it does that in order to keep us safe. Because essentially our body learned like that thing happened, we cannot let it happen again.
Right.
So we begin to be
the perimeter and make the perimeter even smaller.
That's right. That's right. So whereas your capacity might have been here, after this thing that happened, it may shrink because what's happening is our protective mechanisms heighten.
Which, to your point, is kind of miraculous. I mean, it really is. It's amazing that God designed our bodies to deal in short and long term, right? And it sounds like what you're saying is that gift of being able to say, okay, we're going to protect ourselves. It becomes just like many things, not a gift if we are stuck in that space. So it is a gift, but being able to unwrap that is also good, hard work and a gift in itself. And I think that's one of the beautiful arguments, maybe the central argument that you present in Strong Like Water, that this idea of strength, right? I mean, in my hometown, people would say, we're going to get through, we're going to white knuckle. Like that is the version. We've had horrible violence in my community in the last couple of weeks. And I won't talk about it because then I'll just blubber. In a small town near me, don't look nice, Andy. Don't look kind. I'm not looking at your face. It's been so gutting and so hard. And I know that part of the way that some folks are moving through that is to say, we're just going to get through it. That's a very common refrain. We're going to, you know, we're going to barrel through these first few raw weeks of grief and loss, and then we're going to move on. And so while I know that's a gift that our bodies know how to do that, right? How to have a funeral, right? How to go to a funeral after, I understand cognitively what a gift that is. What you're saying in this book is that is a kind of strength. There are multiple kinds of strength that allow us to, as you say, be strong like water, to be, to move and to be more like a willow tree than a redwood, right? That there is a way that we move in and out of these hard things. It doesn't mean that you are always white knuckle, that's what it means to be strong. And for sure, that has been, I think, a message that a lot of people, maybe more people, I don't know if it's, I don't know who's saying this. I surely picked that up growing up, not really from my parents, but just from our community, that the way to be strong is to grit your teeth and get through it. And you're saying that is a version of strength and we don't discount that, but there are other versions as well. Can you reframe that paradigm of what strength really is?
Yeah. Well, I love that you made that connection around how I describe the window of tolerance with this strength idea, because that's really where the in many ways where my thinking for Strong Like Water really began to materialize is because I saw how people viewed, and don't get me wrong, like, it's not that I don't think being in the window of tolerance isn't really valuable. Right. But what I began to see is all these, you know, binaries like, okay, the window of tolerance is good, leaving your window of tolerance bad. You know,
okay.
It's
like
sort
okay.
of this binary way of, and what I felt was this desire. And I think this is really influenced by a lot of my own story of healing. I myself am a survivor of complex trauma. And what I have learned is the essentialness of honoring how we survive. And it doesn't mean that there isn't perhaps a better way through. But when we, that internal war, right? Like, it's like the both and of honoring exactly like what you're saying, that there are times when we sort of don't have a choice.
Right.
And that is so, first of all, painful to know that that is a reality. I mean, that's part of the world that we live in, is that there are really painful things that happen. There is trauma happening. A lot of things are not safe. A lot of things are not okay. And it's not that we want it to be that way, but I'm grateful that when we absolutely have to, our bodies can adapt to continue functioning.
Yep.
Because sometimes the alternate of that, if we didn't have our defense mechanisms to help us psychologically, what that would do to us, it may cause us to no longer exist because the pain is so big, right? And so those defense mechanisms, that's not an accident. Like, they are on purpose and needed. I know for me and many of the clients I work through, there is a deep honoring of why and how you needed to survive, right? And so with that, and with this idea of strength, that really led me to sort of visualize this, what I call the spectrum of strength. This idea, the flow of strength, that it goes all the way from what I would call situational strength. And what I think about with that is this, it's a life or death energy. It is us when we're outside of the window of tolerance, basically. It's whatever we do when it feels like essentially our life is on the line, or maybe the life of someone else. And this could be because of real or perceived threat. Right? Because that to our bodies feels just as true, right? So when we are in a place of feeling activated or triggered around an old trauma, we may be tapping into a life or death energy that at one point we did need. The problem can start to, there can be problems when we're using life or death energy to simply go to the grocery store.
Right. For things that really don't require that anymore. Yeah.
Yeah. Like, if I have to use life or death energy to log into my email.
Yeah. That's out of whack. Yep.
Yep. That, like, I'm using high octane fuel for something that we need to be a little bit easier on our bodies.
Okay.
Right. Because that's what's happening, is that our bodies pay that cost.
Hey everybody, I'm grinning as I say these next words because this announcement has been in the hopper for a very long time. I have a new book releasing April 23, 2024, and it's the result of many, many years of wondering and laughing and some crying too. The book is called Star for Jesus and Other Jobs I Quit, Rediscovering the Grace That Sets Us Free. If you are on the hunt for a book that is story-driven and that makes you laugh and cry and wonder again at what grace actually looks like in real life, this is the book for you. I wrote it for you. Star for Jesus and Other Jobs I Quit is available for pre-order everywhere books are sold. Pre-orders make an author's world go round and help that author keep writing books. So I hope you'll consider pre-ordering a copy of Star for Jesus. Head to my website, KimberlyStewart.com, for all the details, including some sweet free gifts we'll send you when you pre-order the book. thank you for being my people. I am ever in your debt and will absolutely perform an interpretive dance in your honor when we see each other next. And now, back to the conversation.
You mentioned in your book that you a practice for you in your home, which I wish I would have known 10 years ago, you check in with your children and say, can you please pay attention to your body right now? What's your body telling you right now? Mm-hmm. I feel like we've had a lot of experience, particularly in the church, in making really lovely boxes and buckets. There's the spiritual bucket and an emotional bucket and a physical bucket. And I'd say in general, I don't think many people would argue with this, in this moment in faith history, we're just starting to wake up to that those aren't actually so distinct, right? And yeah. that we have prized, I think, the spiritual over the corporeal. Is that how you say that? Mm-hmm. Over mm-hmm. the body. Mm-hmm. And so I love this, that you are talking right now about your body's reaction to things, that you say to your children, can you remember that you are an embodied person, right? Jesus was too. He did not come as a ghost. He mm-hmm. did not come as a feeling. He had a body and he was hungry. And one of the first things he did when he saw his friends after the resurrection was to have breakfast. He was very much in tune to his own body and he made that body. So, and what a beautiful gift it is. So can you talk to me about that when you're saying, you know, let's pay attention to that. How do we do that? A lot of folks mm-hmm. listening might be thinking, I mean, the buckets are very distinct. I don't even know what I'm looking for. Can you talk about that?
Yeah. Well, I think the first thing, I mean, I love that you're touching on that. And I think what I would want to do first is just step out a little bit and just say, again, this is sort of countercultural. And I would say both in the church, in the Western church, I think, but also just Western culture. I mean, we have a very disembodied culture. And I think that there's starting to be a desire, right? There's an acknowledgement like, oh, things have been out of whack for a little bit, you know? But I would say that it's just beginning. And there's a difference between knowing something cognitively and inhabiting the reality. And so I say that to partly acknowledge that when you begin to be a person who desires to live in an embodied way, that it's really normal to press up against the constraints of a culture that might want us like cognitively to be embodied, but in practice doesn't facilitate.
Okay. Tell me more about that.
So like, I think an example would be to say, you know, just like when I'm talking about like kiddos checking in with their bodies, right? Like how often we prize sort of factual knowing over an embodied knowing, right? Now, this is not to say factual knowing doesn't matter. Like I would say I value integration. And embodiment in many ways is integration. It's the way in which we have our full self with us. Whereas what I would say is that when we overvalue things like cognition, it's a type of dissociation. It's a type of disconnection from the body. So like, I just think about, you know, I am so great. I mean, I'm grateful for our schools and I'm grateful for a lot of things, but I think about the way that kids are not really, there's not a lot of facilitation of like kiddos, like listening to their body around even things like, you know, I think the story that you named was around like, it might've been around like potty training or something like that, but it's this experience of listening, the ability to listen, like, am I hungry? Do I need, you know, like, am I thirsty? Do I need to use the restroom? And I think with kiddos, that's one example, but I think about us as adults, like white knuckling is the opposite of embodiment,
right?
Because what it does is it causes us to have to overvalue productivity or getting things done or performing mm-hmm. at the expense of whatever's happening in our body.
Right.
And if you are a person who had a really, let's say you had a really hard week, But then you step into an environment or a community in which it's not okay to attend to what you really need. And maybe that is some alone time, or maybe it's a walk, or maybe it's some reflection, or maybe it's some mindful movement. But because the communal pull to look like you are a certain kind of person is so strong, that that requires a certain type of disembodiment, right? A disconnection. And so all that to say, to come back to, you know, naming this, I would want to just say, like, all of these things, they build on each other. And I love the picture of Jesus showing us, right? Like, here's what it means to not value one part of our humanity, but the fullness.
I think that's it. That's the money shot. And that's another way of talking about integration, what you're saying, that we're not just one. We're not just one bucket, cognitive, yeah, emotional, spiritual, physical. I've even noticed since reading your book how I'm pausing when my heart is racing. Or last night I couldn't sleep and I thought, now why? What's that all about? And being able to, instead of just being like, I have to sleep, right? I'm going straight to the action that I want corrected, moving back one thing, one step, and saying, now, why is my mind racing? Why am I so tired? That doesn't make sense. I've been sleeping well. Or why do I feel anxious in this conversation instead of just getting through to the end of the conversation? So I think that's what you say so beautifully in this book and in your work. We are meant to pay attention. We're meant to pay attention to all the things and to all the ways our bodies and our brains and our spirits are interacting and telling us what's happening, all with so much hope around the bend. And I want listeners to hear that. You know, you write beautifully in your book about revisiting your home, your childhood home, as an adult, and how that was both gutting and hard to see that home and to see it sold. You know, you're moving in out of that space with your family, but your husband was there as well. And I've circled back to that so many times. You write it beautifully, and it's very clear visually to me that while this was a really hard thing, you had tools. You had, as you say, resources. You had some things that you had learned, some precious truths that you had learned about you and your own strength and the strength that God provides and comes alongside with you, that could have railroaded so many months, maybe even years, to go back into that space. And I want listeners to hear that from you, that this work is sacred work and also just drenched in hope.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that is so, thank you for sharing that and how you experience that, because that encourages me. And, you know, I think that's the thing that's so interesting about this work, because I think if it was all just hard, not that it wouldn't be valuable or worthy of honoring, but I think, you know, one of the things I write about is that the sort of this idea that, like, yes, trauma happens in the body, and so does healing.
Right.
Like that it's possible that we are designed actually to heal, that it's not like, how did they heal? It's like, no. We have all that, like, we are made to do this, to be whole, to heal. And that when we have the support and safety we need, there's a way in which there's like a roadmap that God put in your body, each of our bodies, this deep wisdom and intuition that is God-given that knows the way home.
Wow.
And to me, I mean, that's the thing. I mean, as I have experienced this in my own life, but I get to see it with my clients. I get to see with the people, even that I hear feedback from my books, or that it is the fullness of the experiences to honor the pain is also the pathway to the hope and the healing. In that there is a way, you know, the question I realized I didn't fully answer, like, how do people learn to, like, take it out of the separate buckets? And one, it makes me think about this question, is that we learn to bring the buckets together at the pace that we feel safe enough to do so. And what I mean by that is, like, a sense of, like, it might be a little uncomfortable but it's doable. And I think most of us know that, like, as we begin to pay attention, we notice the difference between like, oh, that's a little hard, to like, oh no, I'm never doing that again.
Right.
And so much of this work, for folks listening, I just would want to emphasize the beauty of it is knowing that you are valuable no matter where you are in the process. If you have never done any type of emotional processing for a day in your life, you matter. You're valuable right now, because the value doesn't come from doing the work. Like, it's that because we're so loved, because we are so valuable and cared for, being able to do the work is an outflow of that. And so I think then I find it often gives us courage to just find our own pace. So sometimes it's like, if I've been really disembodied, maybe it's like I learned to just like be with my, I learned to feel my feet. And that's where I start. And maybe, you know, because my chest area just has so many emotions, so that feels a little too scary. But I learn to be with and notice what it's like to really notice, you know, my feet and the sensations on the floor. And it's the slow work of re-inhabiting this God-given body and this life that, interestingly, all of this is connected to the fullness. But we have to find some way onto the path.
How to start. I would love to, I'm going to let you go back to your very full and beautiful life. I would like to quote you to you. I don't know how you feel about that, Andi, but here we go. You write, as we are able, God invites us to see what is, so we can unlearn all the untrue narratives, keep our eyes open for safety and goodness, and enter the deeper and truer story. Dear ones, we don't have to pretend that simply existing doesn't hurt sometimes. It does, and it has. Instead, without bypassing this reality, we are invited to move toward the resources that will allow us to soften into hope. I just love what you've written. I love how you live. Thank you for being a trusted voice in a very complicated and tricky and layered, nuanced space. It is really important to me that you are writing in this space, that you're speaking in it, that you're doing it day by day with your clients, and that you do that holding on, holding fast to your deep and wise faith. That's really, it's very difficult for us. I'm speaking for all of humanity now. I don't know how I transitioned into that role, but it's very difficult to trust going here. Okay. So that you do that both with your very bright mind and your commitment to love Jesus well is just an extraordinary gift. So Andi, thank you for joining us, but also just for doing what you do and for the way you do it.
Thank you so much for having me. I feel truly honored and just seen in your words. So thank you.
I hope you bookmark this episode, friend. My guess is that you are like me and that you'll need to revisit these ideas, maybe even by tomorrow morning, if you or someone you love is healing or hoping to heal. As always, please seek out the help you need. Please do that for yourselves and for each other. And please remember, you are not alone and that you are made to be free and whole and flourishing. That's it for today. I hope you are well to your very bones. Thank you for being willing to learn along with me. And know that we have more conversations coming your way. So stop by again soon. For real.